really excited that Dr. Mordechai Kadar has invited us into his home in order to have a conversation. And we're just going to be going over, I guess, basically your history working in Israel, and then just your general thoughts and opinions on the conflict between Israel, Palestine, the rest of the world, it seems like right now. do you want to go over real quick your background in Israeli intelligence, as much as you're comfortable saying?
Well, I was born in Tel Aviv 71 and a half years ago to a family. My father and my mother originally came from Poland. My mother tongue was Yiddish, but I fell in love in Arabic, in the Arabic world, Arabic culture, Islam, thanks to a great teacher named Dov Iron, may he rest in peace, who was my Arabic teacher in the high school between the 9th and the 12th year. And because we learned Arabic, a group of 13 kids, we learned Arabic very seriously, we went like en bloc to serve in the intelligence when we were recruited in 1970, when we were 18. I spent and served in the intelligence 25 years. And I was released in 1995 in the rank of Brigadier General, I think, what you'd say in the States. Meanwhile, I started my academic career, BA and then PhD in the 90s. I finished my PhD in 1997, and I became a teacher in the university, Bar Ilan, for 28 years. I retired 2 years ago. Meanwhile, I published my PhD in this book in English, Assad in Search of Legitimacy, which actually analyzes the Syrian press from the linguistic point of view. Because here in the Middle East, you know, it runs in Arabic. And if you master Arabic, you know, really well, you can penetrate the minds and hearts even of people. But for this, you have to master the language. Without language, forget it.
We have this problem in the West whenever the Israeli government is publishing videos from either, usually stuff relating to the war in Gaza right now, you'll see in every comment section, people are fighting a lot over, what was the last word, like Shabia? For women that are taken captive, does it mean adult woman? I think for the Israeli translation, they had written in parentheses, like women that can bear children, basically. And a lot of people took issue with how this was phrased, but yeah, just that
there
was over a single word.
There are two words in Arabic which, to the Westerners, sound the same almost. Mm-hmm. One is sabiya, which is a young lady. Young lady. And sabiya, which is a captive lady. Now, captive lady means a lady which you can use for any use. And the question is, what did they say in that movie? Uh-huh. Did they have sabaya, means a plural of young ladies, or plural of sabaya, means plural of captive women, which you can use to any purpose? Apparently, I heard it. It sounds more like the second one.
Sure.
Women which you can use or abuse. By the way, I have a clip on my computer. I think that the people of Daesh, of ISIS, are talking the same way about Yazidi girls which were brought to them. Mm-hmm. So it's the same mindset, Hamas and ISIS.
Do you think that as somebody who studied Arabic really well and can speak fluently and read the language and everything, do you think that there is a failure sometimes to distinguish in Israel between different Arabic countries or communities? Or do you think they all get lumped together? Or do you think there's like an appreciation of the differences between all of them?
One has nothing to do with the other. Mm-hmm. The Arab nation is sharply divided to peoples, as we say, like the Moroccan one and the Algerian one and the Egyptian one and Iraqi and Syria. But in these countries, they are again sharply divided according to the clan, in many cases, according to the religion. You know, in Lebanon, the Christians are speaking different Arabic than the Druze or the Muslims. Once somebody opens his mouth, you know who he is and what he is. Here in Israel, you can hear differences in the pronunciation of Arabic in different villages, different Arab neighborhoods, because those speak in different way from those. Now, this comes in societies which for generations live in clans, because the clannish societies in the Middle East are the result of the desert. In the desert, you have to stick to your source of water and to defend it. Otherwise, you are dead. And in order to defend your source of water, you cannot live as an individual, because the individual is weak while the group is strong. You have to live as a group. And the strongest group is the family, the father and the sons. And after generations, the grandchildren, means the cousins. And after generations, the second cousins. And the third cousins. What do you get? A clan, extended family, some would say tribe. The name doesn't make any difference. The thing is that everybody has to be a relative of each other. And this actually what gives the cohesiveness, which allows them, which enables them to face the other groups in the fight on the water. Because unfortunately, the desert doesn't have enough water. And this is the source of the mindset of the Middle East, which prevails in this area for who knows how many hundreds of thousands of years since human beings started to live in this area.
I'm curious for that, because I've heard you talk about this in regards to your ideal plan for Palestinians would be the kind of the Emirate solution.
Because the Emirate solution is the only thing which is based on the clan. This is why the Emirates in the Gulf, Kuwait, Qatar, the seven Emirates in the United Arab Emirates, seven, and Saudi Arabia and Oman are the only stable countries in the Middle East. Why? Because each and every one of them is one single clan. Kuwait belongs to Al Sabah. Qatar belongs to Al Thani. This is the name of the clan. Dubai belongs to Al Maktoum. Abu Dhabi, Al Nahyan. Saudi Arabia, Al Saud. Okay? So when you base a state on one consolidated, stable group, the country is flourishing. If you have oil like Abu Dhabi and Kuwait, you are rich because of the oil. If you don't have oil like Dubai, you make money out of business. Iraq, Libya, two very heavy oil producers, are mayhem. Hell on earth. Not because of the oil, in spite of the oil. Why? Because they are sharply divided to 70-something clans in Iraq, four ethnic groups, Kurds, Arabs, Turkmens, and Persians, 10 religions, only in Iraq, 10 religions, and sects, who knows how many. Mm-hmm. So when the society is made out of so many groups, which never became a nation, there is no Iraqi nation, there are Iraqi citizens. But unlike in America, which citizenship makes you an American, here in the Middle East, you have to belong to us, to our clan, or to our religion, or to our sect, or our people. Otherwise, hell with you. And this is the mindset of the Middle East. And unfortunately, Westerners, when they come here, and all they know the geography, that Iraq has Euphrates and Tigris and maybe some canals, and that's it. That's what they know. But they don't enter the door of sociology. They don't get it. They don't understand that the Middle Eastern societies work according to totally different rules compared to Western rules in Western Europe or America. Or whatever. And this is the source of all evil. And this is the source of the failures which we saw in Afghanistan, in Iraq, everywhere when the West started or tried to design countries like Syria, like Lebanon, which were all designed by France between the two world wars. These are mayhems. Britain, which established Iraq, learned from the mistake. And when they came out from the Gulf during the 60s into the 70s, they left behind them clannish states, means Emirates. And this is why Emirates are working, functioning, as good countries, not as democracies. They are not democracy. But they, their culture, the clan culture, actually fits the new state, which is based on the traditional culture. While Syria, Iraq, Libya, Sudan, all are based on Western ideas of socialism, like the Ba'ath Party in both in Iraq and Syria, or liberalism, or democracy, or whatever comes from the West, which doesn't fit the societies of the Middle East. Just like if you try to run your iPhone with the system of Android, it doesn't work.
Why do you think, if you look at a country like Egypt, why do you think Egypt was like relatively stable compared to, say, Yemen when that
Egypt went through a process, a very agonizing process of dismemberment of the clans because of the High Dam. The High Dam, the Aswan Dam, which was built during the 50s by the Soviet Union in order to modernize the state because otherwise they had floods because of the Nile, had floods twice a year. But you cannot run a modern country when all the infrastructure is dissolved through the floods twice a year. So they decided to put an end to the floods by building the High Dam in Aswan. And all the peasants who once lived on water, which they got for free from the Nile, now they have to buy water and fertilizers because it's a desert. But who has money? So they moved to the cities. So millions of Egyptians since the 60s, into the 70s, moved from the village to the city, to Cairo, to Alexandria, to Komoshim, Asyut, Dayrut, or Europe, or America, in order to work. So the modern Egypt society is made not by clans, but by individuals who live in Cairo and all these cities. And when you live in individuals, you can bring in ideologies like Islamism, as we see tremendously in Egypt. You can bring in Nazism, like the nationalism of Egypt. You can bring all kinds of isms which do not have to compete with tribalism, which doesn't exist anymore, especially in the cities. Mm-hmm. In the villages, those who remain in the villages are still clannish society, but they are small, they don't have the power, the power is in the city. So this, the Egyptian city resembles, let's say, New York or San Francisco, much more than Baghdad or Damascus.
Okay. And so, when you look at a country like Saudi Arabia, there are so many different people that live here. Is this all like...
No. Saudi Arabia is a country which is run by a family, extended family, named Al Saud.
Yeah.
Is all the descendants of the founding king, who is the father of today's king, Salman bin Abdulaziz. His name was Abdulaziz, but from the family of Saud. And this is why the name of the country, Saudi, Saudi or Saudi Arabia. And as long as this clan, named the Saudi clan, is united, consolidated, and ruling the country, nobody can have any issue with it. Of course, they opposition. They have two oppositions. One in the south, which Bin Laden came from. And one, the Shi'i community, which lives in Saudi Arabia, who lives in the east, next to Bahrain, Hufuf, this part of the country. However, in Saudi Arabia, the name of the religious game is the Wahhabism, because they are part of this sect, kind of religious thinking. And according to the Wahhabism, the Shia is some kind of infidelity to that degree.
Sure.
By the way, this is why they look at the Persians, at Iran, as people who always came out of Islam. This is part of the problem, which unfortunately people do not understand the depth of the enmity between Saudi Arabia and Iran. But it goes to this area as well.
Yeah, I guess my question is, so I don't know the clan makeup of all the people of Saudi Arabia, but I imagine that you have your ruling family. Why is it that that clan was able to rule the entire country instead of having to split the country?
This is actually a combination of clans.
Yeah.
Which the founding father actually married one of the daughters of the leaders mm-hmm. of all the clans which he annexed to his kingdom. He had dozens of wives. And this why all these tribes, they won't rebel against somebody whose daughter is there and her children will be emirs, means princes, or even kings.
So there's got to be something more that would hold it together, though, right? I can't imagine that just America's got to be like...
He united the king. To begin with, I'm talking about 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. He united the kingdom with marriage. But this is the way in the Middle East which you show your allegiance. You give him your daughter. This is the Middle East. 100 years ago, daughters were not asked so much with whom they want to be married. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, or many cases in the Middle East, until this very day, girls are those who will be married with their cousins, second cousin or third cousin, but definitely in the clan, because the other clan is the enemy. You won't give your daughter to your enemy. How come? They're mushminna, as they say in Arabic, not from us. So this is, by the way, the price is tremendous of genetic problems, which are preserved. And in Saudi Arabia, you are not allowed to marry a lady unless you both take a test for the Ministry of Health, and only with their license you can get married in order not to perpetuate genetic problems.
Why do you think, when you look at the Palestinians today in Israel, what would prevent them from engaging in, I guess, a similar sort of like, either through marriage or something else, of being more united? Why do you think it's best for them to work in separate kind of like Emiratis, I guess.
I'm not telling them what to do. Mm-hmm. I, as a researcher, go out and see how they behave. I see a situation that, let's say, in Judea and Samaria, what people call the West Bank. Mm-hmm. If you tell me the family name of somebody, I'll tell you where he lives. If his name is Jabari or Kawasme or Natche, Tamimi or Abu Snena, he lives in Hebron, in Hebron. If his name is Masri or Tukan or Shaka, he lives in Nablus. If his name is Carmi, he lives in Tulkarem. If his name is Arikat, he lives either in Jericho or in another place which is the extension of this place. And that's it. Means this is a clannish society, because in the clan system, clan mindset, the homeland is the village and the tribe or the clan. This is the homeland. If you cross the street and you live within another clan, you will forever be viewed as a foreigner.
Do you think that Arabs in Israel, do you think they share similar feelings, or do you think not?
The Arabs in Israel, who are like 20% of our population, mm-hmm. are what they call in sociology a society in transition. Because on one side, their background is the Arab world, the Islamic world, which is very clannish, and also Islam has what to say. By the way, Islam is rather young, only 14 centuries. Compared to the clan system, which is already who knows how many hundreds of thousands of years. So some of them definitely are still clannish. Some of them are Islamic. Some of them are modern because of the friction between them and the Jewish modern liberal society as we are. Yet the problem is that it's like a half-baked cake. Some parts are closer to us. Some of them are serving in the army, because they are Israelized, I would say, all the way. While others, who, let's say, those who belong to the Islamic movement, especially the northern faction, which is very radical, like Hamas, the Israeli, those whose heart is with Hamas, they, not only they don't serve the army, they consider the state to be a deed of Satan. And that's what they say. And still they are citizens, and they get all the benefits of being a citizen of Israel.
Why do you think that for international media, or at least when I hear international advocacy for Palestinians, do you think that the world community that is pro-Palestinian, or even the Palestinians that are talking about Palestinian issues internationally, are they missing that clan aspect of Palestinians living in Nablus or Ramallah or Hebron? Or because I don't ever hear that internationally when they speak. It's always about like a nation or a country. Yeah,
it's not politically correct to talk about clans. What are they? Clans? Tribes? It doesn't sound politically correct to Western ear. But this is the situation in the Middle East. What I can do? What can I do? The so-called Palestinians are carrying names like Al-Masri, means the Egyptian, Masarwa, Egyptians in plural, Fayumi, from Fayum in Egypt, Ismaili, from Ismailia, a town on the Suez Canal, Al-Khorani, from the Khoran in Syria, Al-Sorani, from Sor, means Tyre, in Lebanon, Sidawi, from Sidon, in Lebanon, Al-Hijazi, Hijaz is in Saudi Arabia, Mecca and Medina. Many of them carry names until this very day, which testify that these people are not originally from here. So what are they doing here? They came to work. Since the Zionist movement started to come to this country towards the end of the 19th century, there were jobs here. Building Tel Aviv was established in 1909, still when the Ottomans were here, before the First World War. So many Arabs, Bedouins, came to work in Tel Aviv because there was jobs and income. And they became Palestinians. Okay, even the Arab world knows their origin, because when they ran out from here in the hostilities of 1948, the War of Independence, they usually ran back to the countries which they came from. But those countries, under the flag of the Arab League, decided not to allow them to go back to the places which they originally came from. And they kept them in the refugee camps until this very day. And unfortunately, the world still resuscitates this problem of the refugees. Where in the world you see refugees from the 40s? Mm-hmm. And their great-grandchildren today are refugees. There is no such a thing in the whole world. Because according to the UNHCR, United Nations High Commission for Refugees, you can be a refugee up to 10 years. Not even one day more. Up to 10 years. Secondly, you cannot inherit it to your children. Your children wait until you make children, until you settle. And the third thing, when you have a citizenship of any country in the world, you're not a refugee anymore. And lo and behold, in Jordan, for example, you have many citizens of the Kingdom of Jordan, yet they consider themselves to be refugees from here, and the world is paying for this. Mind-boggling.
Why do you think, if we even look at like Palestinian leaders, so people like Abbas or people like Arafat, why is it that they seem to be so oriented? Where do you think their desire for a state or a country comes from, that's so separated from this idea of clans or families or where these people actually originate from?
First of all, Mahmoud Abbas was born in Tzfat, which is in the Galilee, neither in Judea and Samaria, let alone Gaza. Mm-hmm. They see him as a foreigner who was brought from Tunisia, you know, in 1993 because of the Oslo agreements, and he's not one of them. This is why he doesn't go to visit neither Hebron nor Nablus, let alone Gaza. Once he was in Gaza, and the bullet passed 10 centimeters near his face and killed one of his bodyguards. Okay, so he understood that he's persona non grata in Gaza, undesirable person. Okay, so he doesn't visit Gaza anymore, and doesn't visit neither Hebron nor Nablus, not anyone, nowhere else. He goes out from his office in Ramallah only to go abroad. Show me another president in the world who functions like this. Now, he was elected in 2006 for 4 years. We are today 14 years after this, because every year the head of the PLO, Abu Mazen, renews the authority of the PA president, Abu Mazen, with his signature. Okay, this is the democracy which...
Sure, I understand. He's
illegitimate.
He
is totally illegitimate, mm-hmm, in the eyes of the Palestinians. And he's acceptable only as long as he brings the money. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is about money. Arafat, formerly, was born in Egypt. And when he became older, he returned to his Egyptian language, and which is a totally different dialect. And he was accepted only as long as he continued the struggle against Israel. even when he was signing on the loan of the White House in September 1993, the Oslo agreements with Israel, he came with uniform as a combatant. Mm-hmm. Excuse me? You sign a peace agreement. Now, he said it always, that this peace agreement is Hudaybiyah peace. Hudaybiyah peace means in Islam, temporary peace.
Yeah, until you can fight again.
Which you give, which a Muslim is allowed to give the infidel, whether the Jew, Christians, or whatever, only as long as the enemy is too strong, invincible, deterring, and dangerous to mess with. In this case, you can give him temporary peace. According to the Islamic mindset, it's called the Salam Hudaybiyah, means the peace of Hudaybiyah. According to the clan system, or clan laws, it's called Hudna. Hudna. So, either Hudna or Hudaybiyah peace, this is what he said to his people every day, that this peace is only temporary peace. And yes, he violated this agreement in 2000, when he thought that we are too weak, that we ran out of Lebanon in the days when Ehud Barak was the prime minister. So then he started the second intifada, started to blow up our buses and our restaurants and people in the street. More than 1,000 people were killed gradually by Arafat and his gangs. And not only this, he established the PA, and the idea was that he will fight Hamas instead of us because we apparently couldn't. And this was, this was the whole raison d'etre of establishing the PA, that Arafat will come in order to fight the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad without Bagatz and without B'Tselem, means without the Supreme Court and without
the rules,
the human rights organizations. Okay, mm-hmm. But he didn't mean at all. Look, what he mean, he actually demonstrates. In this scarf, and this is the PLO flag. On one side they said, Al-Quds Lana, Jerusalem is ours. Since when Jerusalem is theirs? When was Jerusalem a capital of anything connected to the Arab or the Islamic world? Not for one day. But the other side of the scarf is this, Palestine. This is why you need Arabic, Palestine. From the river to the sea. So where is Israel?
Not on that, yeah.
Maybe in the sea, mm-hmm. Among the sharks, okay? And this is Arafat. And unfortunately, we Israelis, especially the left side of the political map, they believed him. And this is why no left left in Israel. There is almost no left. Because they fell in this trap willingly. Because they were warned time and again and again and again. You are deceived by this man. And you know what? Let me give you a story.
Can I ask a quick question before the story?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm curious. So let's say that that's the thought process, that people who are negotiating from these positions, people like Arafat, aren't to be trusted. Do you think that that would have prevented, like, Israel from making peace with Egypt or Israel from making peace with Jordan if that same mentality had persisted? Or why do you think those were different?
Look, when Sadat made the peace with us in 1979, mm-hmm. He had a fatwa. Fatwa means religious ruling. By the Al-Azhar. Al-Azhar is the supreme religious authority of Egypt, which allowed him to make peace with the Zionists, with Israel, just like our prophet Muhammad ibn Abdullah, peace be upon him, gave to the infidels of Mecca in Hudaybiyah. Means that the peace between Israel and Egypt is based on the same idea of temporary peace, which will last only as long as Israel is powerful, dangerous, invincible. When will this pass? I don't know. So far, this peace exists. What will be with the day which they view or think that we are weak? I have no idea. But what they prepare in Sinai doesn't give good thoughts about what the intentions of the Egyptians are.
Do you think that Hussein in Jordan, do you think he felt the same way, that all of that peace was only temporary?
I didn't find the mention of Hudaybiyah in the peace between us and Jordan. Mm-hmm. And this is why the majority of the citizens of Jordan objected. they always say your peace agreement with the ruling family. And the ruling family, don't forget, is not Jordanian. The ruling family is from the Hijaz. They were expelled by the Saudis. And the British gave them the Trans-Jordan Emirate in 1924, which turned to be the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. And the majority, they are like less than 100 people, this family. Mm-hmm. They control a country with 80, 90% of the people who define themselves as Palestinians, who have nothing to do with this clan. And the rest are Bedouins who also do not share much with this clan. Only maybe the language, but not much. So this is the main problem of the Jordanian kingdom. That it is actually based on a family which will rule the country only as long as the army and the intelligence and the security are with them. Because they are vicious. The Palestinians tried in 1970 to rebel against the kingdom. So the kingdom slaughtered them. Thousands of them. Black September.
Yeah.
What happened. So this is Jordan. To say that this family will forever be the kingdom of Jordan, I have no idea.
I'm curious, you mentioned something for Arafat. Do you believe that Arafat, when you said that he kicked off or started the Second Intifada, do you think that he actually like planned and went through and started that? Or do you think he just kind of like hoped it would happen? Or
We have all the proofs. There are books which were written based on documents which were found mm-hmm. in his headquarters that he actually planned. And look, he never meant to take really care of the terror. We know the revolving door. Means when we told him to catch something from Hamas, he would keep the man during the day in, let's say, in one of the police stations. And for the night, he was released to go home in order to come back the next morning. This revolving door. That's what he had. And he conned us day and night, and unfortunately the Israelis under Peres and Rabin and Beilin, all these left, they believed him, that he will fight Hamas without Bagatz and without Bezalel, which this is why they lost the agenda.
Okay, challenging question then. Do you ever feel like, or do you think that Palestinians have a justification for feeling like on the other end, Israel might complain that Arafat never meant to fight against Hamas or fight against any of the terroristic elements of Palestinian society, that Israel never meant to stop the settlement expansions, the outpost building, the terrorist attacks like in the Cave of the Patriarchs. Do you think that Palestinians have a right to feel that type of upsetness, or do you think that it's a bit different on how it plays out for both sides?
Look, I'm looking for solutions mm-hmm. which correspond with sociology. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you get another Syria, or Iraq, or Sudan, or Libya, here. The only solution which will give them stability, us security, and them as well security, is the Emirate solution. The PA, of course, is against it, because it means to dismember the PA. Because by the PA, don't forget, is anyway an artificial structure which we built, mm-hmm. which doesn't correspond with the sociology. The only thing is the Emirates in the cities of Judea and Samaria, Hebron, for the clans of Hebron, Jericho, Ramallah, Jenin, Nablus, Tulkarm, and Kalkilia. Israel should forever remain in the rural areas, offer Israeli citizenship to the villagers. This will give them stability, just like Dubai and Abu Dhabi. Because this is the clan system in the Middle East. The clan definitely, or usually, takes care of its own interests. And if they understand that they are now have the choice between messing with us or flourishing like Dubai, they will choose to be Dubai.
Okay.
And will postpone the desires to see us evaporating.
Sure.
Because we are not.
One more sociology question, and I'm curious. Do you feel like after 67, do you think that the mind of Israel or the Jewish mind or the Zionist mind, do you think it changed or became more ambitious in a good or bad way for territory in the West Bank? Or do you think that look, desire was always there?
Motabe 1967 is actually the remedy for injustice which happened in 1948. Mm-hmm. Look, Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a Jewish capital for over 3,000 years, way before Christianity came to the world, way before Islam came to the world. So Jerusalem should be under Jewish rule. I'm not denying any right of anybody else. Churches should flourish. Mosques should flourish, even the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which originally is not here. The original Al-Aqsa is in Jordan, according to Islamic okay. sources, not in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. But never mind. I think it was brought to Jerusalem by the Umayyads, who wanted to divert the Hajj, for the pilgrimage, from Mecca to Jerusalem, because the Meccans rebelled in 682 CE. So they found Jerusalem as an alternative place for pilgrimage, and they bought, claimed that the Al-Aqsa, which appears in the Quran, Jerusalem doesn't appear. Al-Aqsa, which appears in the Quran, is actually in Jerusalem. And they concocted all these stories about Jerusalem in order to convince the people to come to Jerusalem. So the whole thing about Jerusalem is a concoction. So Jerusalem should be the Jewish capital with full honor to the other religions. I'm not denying anybody's right to worship, or to pray, or to do whatever he likes in Jerusalem, as long as he or she recognizes the Jewish history and the Jewish ownership of Jerusalem. This is the only way how to get along with this. And just to remind you, the only time which Jerusalem is accessible to everybody, Jews, Christians, Muslims, is only when Jerusalem was under Jewish rule. When the Jordanians were occupying illegally Jerusalem and the West Bank as well, by the way, Jerusalem was inaccessible. So history proves.
Okay. So one more time then, do you think after 67, do you think the desire to have Jerusalem, do you think that changed significantly in Israel, or do you think the desire was always there, or?
Look, what happened in 67, because of the shock, mm-hmm. which caught the Arab world, because of the failure which they have, which couldn't be denied, the Arab nationalism actually was shown as an empty slogan, which Gamal Abdel Nasser, the head of the president of Egypt, tried to promote. So the alternative was Islamism. They left, or gradually they left the nationalism because it failed in front of Israel, and the alternative was going back to Islam. And when Islamism became more significant in the Middle East, the Jewish feeling of our people became also higher, because the challenge was religious. And after all, the struggle against us, the basis of this is religious. Because according to Islam, religion is the Jewish religion, and the Christian, by the way, is not in void. Din batil, as they say in Arabic, while only Islam is din haq. The land is an Islamic land, which was given to us in a conspiracy between Christians, Lord Balfour, the evangelical minister of Britain. Britain, yeah. And this was a collaboration of Christians and Jews against Islam, the land, which is Islamic. Jews are not a nation, because according to the Islamic view, we are communities of all the nations in the world, and that's where we belong. And anyway, Jews and Christians should live under the Islamic rule as dhimmis, with limited rights. So Israel, as a state of the Jews, has absolutely no right to exist, even if it was on a square centimeter on the seashore of Tel Aviv, according to the Islamic view. Because religion doesn't exist, Judaism doesn't exist, the land is Islamic, Jews are not a nation, and anyway, they have to live under the Islamic yoke. So for them, settlement is not only Yitzhar and Itamar in Judea and Samaria. It's also Be'eri and Nachal Oz and Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is a settlement in their view. So when you talk about settlements, about our definition or American definition or European definition, this is not the definition of the Middle East. The Middle East sees everything which was built here by Jews as a settlement, which is implicitly illegitimate. So what are we negotiating on? So let me just add.
Yeah, go. Yeah.
The Middle East is run by three vectors. One is the clan system or the clan culture, which is common for Muslims, Druze, Christians in many cases, Alawis, and many other groups which live in the Middle East, not only Muslims. And this culture is already hundreds of thousands of years old. The second vector is Islam, which came to the world only 14 centuries ago in order to correct some problems of tribalism. And this, it pulls the Middle East to another direction, to the religious direction. The third vector is modernism, which infiltrated into the Middle East since 215 years ago, more or less. And these three horses are pulling the Middle Eastern wagon to three different directions. This is why it's so hard for Westerners, who are thinking in a Western way, to understand this system, which is pulled by three vectors.
I'm curious, just on that three, when you look at a country like Saudi Arabia, which one of those three do you think they represent in your mind?
Saudi Arabia is representing a combination mm-hmm. of religious pole on one side and the clan pole on the other side, some kind of conjunction between both, or mix of both. They take the modernism only when it comes to tools, car, cell phone, computer. They reject, usually, the Western values, freedom, democracy, equality, men and women, all these things. So they know very well how to pick from the third vector what serves the
other
mode,
two. Okay.
What and what undermines the two first ones, mm-hmm. the clan system and the religious system.
Who do you, I'm just curious, in terms of writing about like this balance of the Middle East, have you ever written anything larger on it or just?
Well, I published only one book mm-hmm. because people prefer either articles or YouTube.
Yeah, unfortunately,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, the one book which I published is this, Assad in Search of Legitimacy, mm-hmm. Message in Rhetoric in the Syrian Press under Hafez and Bashar. This is based on my PhD. Mm-hmm. It was published in 2005 by Sussex Academic Press. And it actually analyzes the Syrian press in order to understand how Assad, both father and son, Hafez and Bashar, think. Mm-hmm. And in my humble view, this is the best, of course, I hope.
yeah.
The best analysis of how the Syrian regime thinks.
Okay.
Because unlike Western countries where the press is free, there, the press is directed by the government. And therefore, the press actually expresses what the government wants, means what the president wants. Mm-hmm. Just like EKG, which you put on your body.
Yeah, I understand.
You don't have to penetrate your heart. It's enough that you put some electrodes and you analyze them. Mm-hmm. This is the same thing. Analyze what they say and you can understand, like reverse engineering. Analyze what they say mm-hmm. to understand what they think. And I already predicted that this system named Syria cannot work forever. I didn't predict when and how it will erupt as it did in 2010, but definitely this system cannot work for a long time.
Okay. And then I'm curious, one more question. So hopefully, I'm pretty sure on this trip, I'm going to have the chance to talk with Shlomo Ben-Ami and with Balin. What do you think, when I talk to those two, because I'm curious, I'll ask them their opinions on this. What do you think their biggest contention is with your narrativization or your theory of how the Middle East works? What do you think they would disagree with you the most on?
Start with the fact that both of them do not speak Arabic.
Okay, yeah, that's okay.
Means they miss the main tool to understand their counterparts. Mm-hmm. And if you don't understand your counterpart for a negotiation, the chances that you make a big mistake are at least 100%.
Okay.
At least.
Wait, on that, so when you look at like big negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis, are there ever ordinarily people involved in these negotiations that are fluent in Arabic, or? Like for Camp David or for Oslo or?
Unfortunately, not too many. Okay. Begin, in his time, had an advisor, actually my teacher, Professor Moshe Sharon. He spoke Arabic fluently. He was expert in Arabic. Mm-hmm. And as long as he was in office, he made sure that Begin doesn't make big mistakes.
Okay.
However, when the Egyptians understood that this man understands too much, they demanded to oust him from the Israeli crew. And unfortunately, Begin agreed.
And you said that guy's name was Moshe Sharon?
Moshe Sharon was his name.
Okay.
And those who actually pulled Begin was Dayan and Ezra Weizman, who were great officers in the army,
but
understood very little in the Arab societies. Just like many, you know, army people who think like tanks and cannons and air force and navy, but they understand very little about the societies which they have to deal with. And in my humble view, Israel and Westerners will continue to make mistakes in the Middle East as long as they don't take the sociology of the Middle East as the main tool to understand what to do and how to do in the Middle East. Failures like Iraq and Afghanistan will repeat themselves time and again until people learn the sociology of the Middle East and the languages of the Middle East.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Oh my God, look, he's at the perfect height for hugs. I've got it. Hi, baby. Kitty, no. Come get hugs. Hi, baby. He's never, ever coming here. Hi, baby. Okay. Let's go.